Peacock Hill, an 860-acre ecological reserve at the edge of downtown Tucson, Arizona, is an active research center where multiple approaches come together to better understand the Sonoran Desert and arid environments. A large swath of beautiful Sonoran Desert in the heart of a city, Tumamoc Hill is an ecology, a site of community gathering, conservation, art, archaeology, history. With over 2,500 years of human use, 115 years of science, and more visitation at this time than any time in history, Tumamoc Hill is indeed a living laboratory, a refuge for exercise, health, and reflection. What does it take to run one of the most anthropologically, ecologically, gastronomically, and culturally important places in the world, and what are the dreams for its future? There isn't a person on the planet, in my opinion, that's more qualified and more excited to answer those questions than Dr. Benjamin Wilder, the new director of Tumamoc Hill. Stay with me to hear about what he has to share. Hi, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as many of you know, the MGW mantra for this year is hashtag 12 years to change. That's the message from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in the report they published in October of 2018, informing us that that's how much longer we have to dramatically reduce greenhouse gases or face dire consequences as a planet. We're going to get some hope about that conversation. But before I get started with the guest, I'd like to thank the sponsor of this show, the University of Arizona. In my humble opinion, and as a graduate of the University of Arizona, full disclosure, I believe the U of A is one of the true leaders when it comes to cutting-edge research on every aspect of combating climate change that can be imagined. Some of the world's top climate scientists, including world-respected women scientists, are doing remarkable and important work in incredibly diverse areas. And Mrs. Green's World is proud of our partnership with them, and we take every opportunity we can to spread the word about the important work going on there. So as I said, our guest today is one of those outstanding scientists and is all about being part of the solution. His name is indeed Dr. Benjamin Wilder, Director, Desert Laboratory on Tumamoc Hill. Ben, it is wonderful and exciting to have you here. And we talked a little bit before we got on air. And once again, I went down the rabbit hole of research because the more you know about Tumamoc Hill, the more you want to know. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Oh, that's definitely the truth.
It's like, wow, and they do this, and they do that, and they do this. So that's enough of my thoughts and my opinions for now, because we want to have you weigh in. And I think, you know, it's always like, where's the best place to start? And I love when I can start with a quote from a great website that jumped out at me to help people understand the concept of Tumamoc Hill as a living laboratory. And that quote is, with over 2,500 years of human use, 115 years of science, and more visitation today than at any other time in history, Tumamoc Hill is a living laboratory, a refuge for exercise, health, and reflection. I said it at the top of the show. So let's go one by one. 2,500 years of human use. Significance, perspective. Tell us why that's right there in big, bold letters.
Yeah, and that's the perfect place to start, really. It, you know, maybe the best way to dig into that is it all connects to water. Water is life in the desert. And that is as true today as it has been for thousands of years. And so how that connects to specifically Tumamoc Hill is the Santa Cruz River. One of the more important perennial rivers in the Southwest up until about the 1930s when many effects, including most importantly groundwater pumping, dried the river up to the condition it is today. But going back, you know, not even 80, 100 years, and then back for millennia, it was this beautiful gallery forest riparian system. Starting in northern Mexico and then flowing to the north, as many of the rivers of the Southwest do, including the San Pedro nearby. And so that it was people gathering around this source of consistent and dependable water that actually makes the Tucson Valley the longest continuously inhabited site in the United States. And that's going back at least 4,000 years, if not longer. So the Tumamoc Hill is about an 800-foot elevation rise of a hill's a bit of a misnomer, closer to a mountain.
especially if you're walking.
Especially if you're walking, as many would agree. That has stunning vantage point from the top. You can see everything from the top, the entire valley. And everyone can see you in many ways, thinking especially back to wanting to know who's coming on the landscape.
Right.
So the strategic significance of that continues to be very much the case. So, yeah, but it's really the connection between the water and then that strategic place, and that synergy continues to resonate today, but that's why we have such an important archaeological history on the site.
You know, I can't help but reflect on that, because when people want to know about how science and research connects to human-caused climate change, you just gave the essence of how. Mm. Because humans started to pump the groundwater and the river dried up, and that created an ecological ripple that is being felt up to and including today. And I love it when I hear people like, you know, Juan Murrieta from Watershed Management, who paints a vision for us of the Santa Cruz running again and what it would take. So it's human cause. Well, maybe as humans we can figure out a way. The pictures that I have seen, it was amazing. I mean, yes. It looks like back east.
Absolutely.
The rivers, yes.
Yeah, so. You walk in, it's like walking into a mangrove estuary almost, and you walk into this gallery riparian forest, and you're, you know, 10 meters outside of that, there's creosote scrub, and it's hot and arid, and then you walk in, and you're just transported to this lush, beautiful
gorgeous
world. Yeah.
So another thing that surprised me, and I love surprises, but again, 115 years of science, I found that interesting and surprising, so I would really like you to explain to us, what do you mean 115 years of science? Has the research been going on there that long?
Yeah, it has. Everything has a fascinating story and history to it, and this connects to scientists from the East Coast coming out to the West. The first, really, where this kind of began was in 1890, when Frederick Vernon Colville, a scientist who was at the Smithsonian, a great botanist from the East Coast, went to Death Valley and was just taken aback by how the heck can plants survive here?
I know, no kidding, when it's hard for humans.
How are they doing it? What's the physiology? And that wasn't known. The different types of photosynthesis, C4 photosynthesis, CAM photosynthesis, that wasn't known. These are ways to adapt to arid conditions. And so fast forward a little bit, the idea stuck in Colville's mind. In the 1902, Andrew Carnegie established the Carnegie Institution of Washington, D.C., now the Carnegie Institution for Science. And Colville presented this idea. And the board was really taken by it, because that really was the frontier of research at that time, especially in plant biology. So they said, go forth and explore and look for a laboratory site. The committee of two people, him and D.T. McDougall.
That's a great size for a committee.
can get things done that way.
Yes.
From the New York Botanical Garden at that time, went throughout the West looking for a site, and from Guaymas, Sonora, to Southern California, to New Mexico, but they saw the Tumamoc Hill on the edge of it. What that time was starting to become a bustling city. The University of Arizona was here from 1885. The railroad was now here, so there was connections to the rest of the country. And anyway, they established the Desert Botanical Laboratory on that site. I don't know if they quite knew the cultural importance and history at that time. I doubt it. I'm sure they knew to some extent. But what we were just talking, I don't think they knew how important it was. So, and that time, one of the first things they did was they fenced the property to exclude cattle and turned those 860 acres an ecological reserve, which is now the plots and the work that they established. It's the longest continuously monitored arid land vegetation studies in the world.
I frequently wish that we had a video component, that we were being filmed, because then when I read about the plots and you see what has been studied, it's amazing. And we will definitely get into that. And then we can't really go on to the next segment unless we talk what I think is an interesting bedfellow, is what I call it, because there's the science and the research and the preserve itself. But then there's the number of people that climb Tumamoc every day. People wear it as a badge of honor. Have you climbed Tumamoc? It's really hard. Mm-hmm. How many people roughly a day go up and down that hill?
Yeah, we average about 1,000 people a day that are hiking.
Is everybody listening? 1,000 people a day, and you have to find parking, and you have to really think it, which isn't easy. It's in the city, and people do it. I have never been there when there were not hundreds of people.
Yeah.
It's just so it's combining. It is the living lab. To me, that was the piece that brought the human population living into that conversation.
And one of the more exciting, I think, beautiful components of that use of the hill is it is Tucson. It is our community. I say it's the most natural, perhaps impressive representation of the census of the city of Tucson. I mean, you look at, slice it from
the
any
diversity,
way, socioeconomic, cultural, age, background. It's all of us,
and it's free,
and darn right,
that's important to me. Yeah. It's free, so it's not an economic decision if you can go walk in it.
No, it's a place to connect to nature, to friends, to yourself, to recover from an injury, an illness, to shake off a bad day, to celebrate. It in the connection between those of us that use the hill for exercise is really personal, and it's something maybe to explore further, but that it goes beyond, I think, connections that many of us have to our gym or to other places. And then that connection between people and place is so interesting, just in the moment. But thinking about the long history we're just talking about, is all of us that use the hill today we're the most recent chapter in this long history of use of this site that goes back thousands of years in this desert city.
Well, since I first met you, and we just have to say, a big shout out to your dad, Janos, who I am a great admirer of and friend, and he did our Mrs. Green Goes to Sea cruise about 9 years ago when he cooked healthy food. We went to Pike's Market in Seattle, and he got all this fresh fish, and that's when we really got to be friends.
But why wasn't I there for that?
Because you were probably 8.
All right.
I don't know. But you are so passionate, and from the time I met you and had you on our, community radio show, KXEI, you're so passionate, and I want to talk about, I really want to go into some of the, what's there in your piece of managing. So talk about the library. It's like magnificent and significance.
Yeah, so the lab buildings were built in 1903, and it continued on for various years after that, but really date to 1903, 1906, built of the volcanic rock of the hill. And they knew what they were doing when they built those buildings. I mean, they're robust, beautiful windows that go up almost floor to ceiling, high, almost 20-foot high ceilings.
I want to live there. That's how you feel when you're going, I could stay here and never leave.
It feels like you're transported. And then that's one of the exciting things in terms of all of what we do at the Hill is time has a different pace there, both in terms of the research we're doing, which is very long-term, but also in the work you're doing. You're kind of removed from that hustle and bustle of academic life on campus. It's really set aside, and the library is a perfect example of that. So it is, we're well in the process of making it the world's best collection of scholarly work focused on arid Southwest and arid environments in the world. And it's filled with treasures from the early lab scientists that were just, again, like we were talking about, discovering the forefront of how plants are adapting to arid environments. The journal that they created there, which became the Journal of Ecology, and the kind of the establishing the discipline of ecology in North America, coalesced from the research at the lab in their early years, to just having a space to kind of reflect and study. I think that the digital transition is miraculous and wonderful, but hard copy books cannot be replaced.
Oh my gosh, thank you for saying that.
We're making a refuge for them.
It matters.
Yeah.
I know, and hard copy books are not as green,
yeah.
But if I get one, I keep it and it stays in circulation, and I hope we never see the day where books go away.
Yeah.
So that's huge to me. I wanted to really highlight the library. And then I want you to talk to me about, because I had questions when I was reading it. I'm not a scientist. I know a lot. But when I look through the lens of the IPCC report, which I pretty much have those glasses on now all the time, thus the moniker Henny Penny, the sky's falling, pay attention, let's do the good work. So tell us about the Spalding maps and their significance, because they, even now more than ever, in my opinion, the significance continues to increase.
Yeah.
It's not diminished, it's increasing.
And I mean, I think the Spalding plots, as we'll get into, really talk to the importance of sound, careful science. And so,
yes.
Volney Spalding was originally from Michigan and came out to the lab, one of the first scientists at the lab. In 1908, he decided that he wanted to get a better understanding of the saguaros on the property. So he mapped every single one of them in the whole property, which were thousands of individuals.
Of which there are many.
Thousands. And took measurements of them. And so, at the same time, that was fascinating in itself, and actually it showed that there are very few young individuals at that time, which caused some alarm. At the same time, they also established these permanent vegetation plots, 10 by 10 meters in size, where they mapped the crowns, the aerial coverage of each of the perennial plants, and there are about 19 of them. Okay, that sounds like an interesting one-off exercise.
For a scientist.
Not a one-off exercise. The idea was to track both of these populations and look at the exact same pieces of land, the exact same individuals through time. Now, when he set this up in the early 1900s, I don't know if he was thinking this was a five-year thing,
probably
a two-year
not.
Thing. I doubt it. It was a lot of energy. But his faith and his kind of really stroke of genius, honestly, in terms of thinking about the long term, was rewarded. And the fact that we still monitor and take the same data that he started doing, and we're in bringing in new technologies to expand and the aerial coverage and use these as kind of ground truths to then look at the larger landscape. But we continued to look at the exact same pieces of land, and the results of 115 years of data is unparalleled, because what happens is if you look at one of these plots or collectively over 5 years, well, you're going to find some things. It can be very interesting, and you're going to kind of get some results and conclusions from that. But then you keep looking at 10 years, 15 years, and this story changes dramatically. So perhaps those first 5 years were very wet. And then maybe in year 7, there was a really intense freeze that came through and actually killed many of the saguaros. And then you had the following 5 or 10 years were very low populations. But then you had another great rain year, and all the saguaros were established. And so what we know is that the desert is very pulse-based. It responds to incredible rainfall events or freeze events, so singular events that can last in minutes even, that those have ripple effects that go years, if not decades. And at the same time, the plants and animals and people can hunker in and for those really long dry spells. So that incredible variation and really boom and bust cycle is the DNA of adapting to the desert.
And I when I was doing the research, I kept thinking the word that kept screaming at me in the back of my head, because I know a little bit, I know enough to be very dangerous, is biomimicry. Mm-hmm. Those people that are studying how things adapt in nature, this has to be ultimately of interest to them, because you have that long view, and we're going to need to learn a lot from how things survive in arid climates, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And Rafe Sagarin comes to mind, a dear friend, unfortunately no longer with
just
us.
Just sat in that chair where you're in many times. No.
And he was on, this is how he thought, and there's so many lessons to be learned right outside his door.
And everybody always did what he asked. he asked things of me, like, you have to be on the SATO board. And I'm like, okay, Rafe. And unfortunately, he was killed in a very tragic accident way too soon. But his legacy lives on as, obviously, we are talking about him.
Absolutely.
And everybody takes a breath. Mm-hmm. Rafe Sagarin was an impact on my life.
Yeah. He saw that there's so much to be, and to slow down and to think through different lenses and to really try to incorporate what life all around us has had thousands and millions of years to adapt and to learn, and we can learn from that. And I think it's also important to really think about traditional ecological knowledge in that way, and that we people have known how to live in an arid environment very successfully. And so there's a lot we can continue to
learn. There's going to be a lot of people asking us how do you do this. Mm-hmm. So explain to us, as a scientist, the difference or the significance of a living laboratory outside versus a simulated under greenhouse, whatever. Right. Tell us the significance of being able to do that.
I think what it means to me, maybe first and foremost right now, as I think about it, is we have 1,000 people a day walking through our laboratory. So it creates perhaps some conflict or challenges, but it's what an opportunity to communicate, what an opportunity to share what science is and what careful data taking, experimentation, and what can be gained from that. I think so often the results of science are obtuse, and they're buried in jargon filled papers behind paywalls and at conferences, and they never get out to the public. And a living laboratory to me means taking all of those barriers down and welcoming people into the process. And also helping them understand that we need to have, if sites are sensitive, and this is a very sensitive site, Tumwalk Hill, especially for the cultural and scientific reasons. But you can be part of and feel part of the process. And the other thing I think living laboratory also means is that today our 860 acres are no longer surrounded by open deserts and the river. We are in the middle of the city.
Right in the heart of an ever-developing area, even.
So it is a true fragment. Yeah. It's an interesting case because that's a large enough tract of land that it can be quite healthy. We have resident deer populations, bobcats, coyotes, a beautiful, healthy environment. But we are a fragment. And that's, that is the future for so many areas around the world, this urban wildland interface. And so while the original questions from 1910 are not the exact same we can ask today, all that baseline information allows us to then think about fragmentation and corridors and connectivity for wildlife and pollinators in a new light that is relevant to so much of the landscape.
And what occurred to me as a layperson when I was reflecting, because even not even being on Tumwalk Hill preparing for this show made me reflect, is that it's not imitating nature, it is nature. Mm-hmm. So when you're in a closed environment, you're trying to emulate, simulate, imitate, whatever, this is nature and you're studying it.
Exactly.
It's how it comes to us, whatever that period is, or the freeze, or so much rain, or whatever happens, you get to research it.
And it allows such great connectivity with the other scales and other approaches to science. So we were just talking about at the University of Arizona, you have that full spectrum or gradient from the greenhouse manipulated small control environments to kind of even at the petri dish level. Then think about biosphere 2 and these enclosed environments where you control more over the variables. And then you have the full out there, all the elements, the landscape of Tumwalk Hill. And so combined studies across those ranges are just ever more powerful.
The integration of all of those things. Yes, it's incredible. So 35 years of research is one of the actual tabs on your website. And I was excited to learn about some of them. And I didn't research every single one, but there are things like plant responses to changing environments, which we talked about, bed hedging with seed banks.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that for a little bit, because I'm a seed bank junkie. We have native seed search here. I've interviewed people from some of the largest seed banks in the country. So tell us about bet hedging with seed banks.
Oh, so this is work that our director of research, Larry Venable, has pioneered. And
he's a rock star. I read a lot about him.
Evolutionary biology. Man, he's fantastic. And he's utilized the annual flora. So we're speaking during what I am. Like, talk about bet hedging. All my chips are in the middle of the table for the wildflower bloom this spring. I am so excited for the rain we've had and the flowers I think are coming.
It sounds like I have to come out there and do a video with you.
Oh, this is going to be good.
Yay, we love it when that happens in the desert. It becomes alive.
And so what Larry's research has been is, okay, so where are those flowers coming from? It's an ephemeral, an annual plant, flowers and goes to seed all in 1 year, sometimes even less in one season. Remarkably, the flora of the Sonoran Desert is almost 50%, almost half of it, is annual plants. That's a lot of diversity.
That's a lot, yes.
And so within that, there's a lot of different ways to be an annual plant. And then you think about all the different variables and the variants and the extremes that they have to deal with. So let's say it just rains a little bit. Well, then some of the cues will be for those seeds to germinate and to release. But then if it's just a little bit of rain and you get a dry spell or a freeze, or, I mean, they're done. They've lost all that. So what many of these species have adapted, evolved to do is they will hedge their bets. They will hold back. They will not be cued by that initial rain. Some will, and it will go to seed and will germinate. But many will hold back, waiting for that second or third or even fourth rain that then will ensure that there's enough soil moisture to go forward.
Like, I'm shaking my head. It's really unreal. And nature, keep thinking, you can't even get your head around it, the complexity and the beauty of it. So I wonder if this is a fair question. Is some of the research used to, and I may be getting ahead of myself, to do any intervention in the area? Like, if something is disappearing, or would you ever plant more saguaros, or is the purpose to study what is and keep it as it is and learn from that?
Both.
Okay, so, which is a great answer. I think it's one worth asking.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're... So, us, the Desert Laboratory, Tumamoc Hill, and maybe this gets into invasive species a little bit. But
which we want to talk about.
We're at the point where we're not having to do, I think a term that pops to my mind, what you described, assisted migration. Or when you're having really active management on the landscape. That's not so much our context of what we're having to deal with at this point. However, that is so much of a piece of the future of landscape management. I'm just think about climate adaptations and restoration activities. My wife actually is working on a project in California that's focused on what are the right species to use for large-scale restoration after fires or erosion or floods or whatnot. And if you you want to think about the species that are, and actually at the population levels, that are climatically adapted for what the future climate will be like in that area that needs the restoration activity. So that's thinking about bringing in specific species or populations that aren't from that area. Similarly, is thinking about assisted migrations, helping certain populations of rare plants, rare animals, kind of make, because everything's so fragmented, assisting them over those breaks in habitat to get to the new climate-friendly environment. So that's actually absolutely happening.
Okay, so another part of his research that's under the 35 years of annual plant research, tell us about what is a seed predator? And I you know, I'm a layman and I have a sick sense of humor, as you know. So I thought, well, one seed predator are birds, and I was kidding. But what's a seed predator and how does it impact plant species diversity?
So a seed predator can be anything to, like you said, to birds or ants, and fungal pathogens.
Got it.
And so there, I would also say certain freezes can be
right, seed predators. Right.
And so that it's just, there's a, Another great example is actually, so the white-winged doves that visit the saguaro flowers, in many ways, they were thought to be dispersers of the seeds as well, because they visit and eat the saguaro fruits. Their process of eating the seeds and their gizzard, they actually are, it's like a grain mill. And they actually grind up the saguaro seeds, and they're not viable.
They're thieves.
They're a seed predator.
That's a great example.
And so it really leads into the numbers game, that there are so many ways for a seed to not survive and not be able to establish that it's either you put in energy into making tons of seeds that go all over the place, or you invest a lot of resources into larger seeds that are a bit more robust and can maybe weather some of the challenges they face. It's kind of in the academic speak, that's R versus K strategy, which you see not just in plants but in animals as well.
Right. So I said to you when you first got here, we cannot talk about all the research that's going on there, because this is not a series today. It's like, I want to do a series now on Tumamoc Hill that goes around the world. But what are some of the highlights? And I hope as part of that, I want to talk about two things before we go on to anything else eventually. Agave and buffle grass. Mm-hmm. Two very different examples. Mm-hmm. But I got to be hooked on Tumamoc Hill through the Agave Festival.
Yeah.
And I went to see numerous films at the Loft. And the importance of the agave plant, it actually blew me away. The cultural pieces of it, the survivability of it, it's unbelievable. So talk to us about agave.
So yeah, both of those are really good places to start. I think maybe to kind of put a context of it, that original question that the lab was founded on is, how do plants adapt to aridity, is as meaningful today as it was at the outset of the laboratory, and in many ways maybe even more so. And so that's kind of the angle that we take in the big picture of how we do the work. So agave, perfect example. What a beautiful desert plant. It has its Mayahuel. It has the goddess of agave. That, for scientists, in part because of its products of Bacanora, Mezcal, is a dear friend of all of us.
Right.
So
there was a little of that at the festival.
So the agave plant itself is really interesting. It's very hardy, and it flowers once, monocarpic, and then it dies.
And is that ever gorgeous? When you talk about majesty,
right,
and the desert speaks, yeah.
And so that kind of approach to reproduction, and actually there's multiple ways the agave reproduces, with including vegetatively through offsets, but with that flower stalk, it leads itself to a lot of really interesting uses. So in short, what happens is, through those spiny kind of leaves, the agave leaves, the plant concentrates all of its resources, sugars, carbohydrates, in its center. And then what it's doing is it's preparing to send up that really tall stalk that goes up. Well, what people have done for millennia is they'll cut off, they won't even let the stalk develop, and they'll harvest the plant, cut its leaves off, and then you have this pina, or the heart, the center of the agave plant, which is just loaded in nutrients. And then you roast it in pits, roasting pits. And that caramelizes and brings forth all of these sugars. And that was one of the major food sources for people in arid lands from northern Arizona through central southern Mexico.
And maybe again.
and is happening again, absolutely. At that same time, you can also take that roasted piña, and then you can mash it up and then distill it, and then that's how you get tequila. So on Tumamoc Hill, we have a large field, a good almost fifth or about 70, 80 acres of the property are ancient agave fields, where there are rock piles mounded on the edge of these slopes with little rock cairns bringing the water, just the overland sheet flow, harvesting the water and diverting it to these rock piles that act as mulch to create the extra moisture where they would plant the agaves on. The agaves would not grow on that landscape without that system. And then they would harvest them and roast them and they eat them for food. And so one of the researchers who was based at the Desert Lab, Howard Scott Gentry, in the 1940s, he named it the agave human symbiosis.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Totally the case, yeah. Wherein it's that the agave gives humans, gives people life-giving nourishment and food, but at the same time, it's people that are working with it, and there's as many diversities and races of agaves, just like corn or potatoes. It's people. It's a close husbandry and connection through time, and that's actually how much people have shaped the diversity of agaves is at the forefront of the research.
And one of the movies I saw, like, it was jaw-dropping because you see the multiple uses, mm-hmm. including. It's so durable, the fibers, and they make clothing out of it. And the native people that have respect for it, it's part of their cultural heritage, part of ceremonies for young women. It's unbelievable, the multiple uses, because if you are living off the land, you don't waste anything.
Right.
And those movies certainly taught me about, certainly, I always respected them for their beauty, mm-hmm. but now for their use. It's pretty mind-blowing.
And it's also a great cultural connector as well. I would say the range of agave and the cultures that have connected to it seamlessly go north and south across the border between the U.S. and Mexico. So the Agave Heritage Festival, which you recognize, is such a recognition of all of this beauty, all this culture, and all this respect and connection, I would say, both to the plant, but also to between each of us and U.S. and Mexico.
And I have to ask our friend Todd from Hotel Congress if he's more enamored with the multiple uses of agave or the mezcal. He'd appreciate that my humor in this regard.
I think that may be another both answer.
D, all of the above. So you talked about invasive species, and in a lot of the conversations I've had with friends who are in biomimicry, talking about that being one of the biggest challenges, and not talking specifically about that biomimicry, but a lot of the wildfires are a result of climate change and invasive species. Here in Tucson, it is an invasive species, and when you talk about it spreading like wildfire, it's such a threat to us. What's going on in that arena? I said to you, I was at a breakfast this morning and someone brought it up. You know, we have an initiative here, Beat Back Buffalo Grass, because it's a threat to the saguaros.
Yeah.
It's a threat to our homes in hot season. So talk to us about buffalo grass.
Yeah, so buffalo grass and invasive species, I really think, are the elephant in the room. They're fundamentally threatening the sense of place of our regions.
That's profoundly important when you say that.
Yeah.
Threatening our sense of place.
And I think the thing is, so for us in this region, the enemy number one, threat number one is buffalo grass. But every community across the world, honestly, at this point, has an invasive species that is really altering the landscape to a way that it's, in many ways, it's unrecognizable for those that have been there, grew up in an area. For us, we look up on the Catalina Mountains and see this kind of pale yellow color on the slopes, and that wasn't there before, and that's a paddock, as to use the Australian term, a whole kind of blanket, dense population of buffalo grass. So it's a African perennial bunch grass that evolved with fire. And so essentially, what's happened is it was brought in for cattle forage and erosion control to many places apart in the world. Australia has incredible and intense situation with buffalo grass. Hawaii, South America, and here in the Southwest, especially in Mexico, in the Sonora in Mexico, and here in Arizona. And you got to tip your hat to this species. It is
tough. It is tough, and it should be spelled like buffalo instead of the E-L. It's buffalo, and it's incredibly
invasive. It's found its niche in the desert in a way that's very much extreme from beyond what is in Africa, with its natural predators and or blights or things that keep it in check. It's not kept in check in this region, and it's expanding exponentially. And so what the real concern comes from, that it introduces a fire regime to the desert, which the desert has never known throughout its evolutionary history. Saguaros, Palo Verdes, what do you think about them?
Not a lot of fuel.
Photosynthetic bark. And so when the fire comes, they're killed pretty much instantaneously. And the Palo Verde itself is this nurse tree. It is one of the keystone species for this desert that creates this microhabitat underneath it that all these other species can recruit under. So you're just knocking out core pillars of our ecosystem that that can't be replaced without maybe going to restoration and some of those real active management situations we were talking about earlier. But that is so difficult, and we don't even know how to do that, honestly. It'd be starting from square one.
Not on that scale.
Not even close. And so, but what's happening is that, just talking about Buffelgrass, the expansion is so extensive and so rapid that it outpaces management and jurisdictional capacity. We're stuck by the limits of our ability to react to such a rapidly changing situation on the landscape, which is hemmed in by budget cuts and different governance approaches and delineations of land tenure, and it gets very complicated. Meanwhile, the plant's not listening to any of that. It just keeps marching on. And that's not just the case with Buffelgrass. That's the case with cheatgrass, brome, Brassica ternifordii, zebra mussels. There's all these cases doing the same thing. So it really, what I think is so interesting about this is that it creates clear and present danger to our landscape and with massive economic impacts. And thinking about tourism and our sense of place and
yes,
the saguaro, the icon of the Sonoran Desert. But at the same time, these species are responding to global scale forces, climate change, globalization. The rate of spread and movement of species across the globe is unprecedented in the history of the planet. One of the things that blew me away was from the tsunami in Japan. After the rafting of material, man-made material, across the Pacific to California carried hundreds of species that were able to persist in this plastic rafts that then were able to make landfall up and down the coast in about 3 years or so after the tsunami. That's one of the largest gaps of ocean in, I mean, it is the largest
on the planet.
Gap. And
yes,
that species are making that transition in order of years. So the movement of species across the landscape and then responding to a shift in climate, it's a double whammy that is a force that's larger than anything we can really hope to. I don't think it's something we maybe necessarily should be hoping to stop because it's so large, but how do we adapt to it? What are the importance of each of our societies? What is important to us? What is the quality of life? What is it we want for an economy? And invasive species are a massive thing to take into effect. That and I think areas like Tumamoc Hill, Saguaro National Park, the Tucson Mountains, hopefully the Catalina Foothills are areas that we as a society identify that need to be preserved. And we know how to do that. We can be successful. But I think it's important to know this is part of a larger picture as well.
It's big. And thank you for what I call integrating all of that together, putting it together, synthesizing it so that it's really a global picture. And I did not know I'm obsessed with the impacts of the tsunami. You never hear about it. And I have a dear friend in San Francisco that is very actively studying still what's happening from the nuclear waste. And that's a problem that will never go away in my lifetime.
Yeah.
Never. They still have no idea what to do and how to deal with it. So it's just, it's a forever kind of thing. Before we go on to my next question, is there any other, I mean, there's so much significant research. Is there anything else that you feel like you, if you got in the car, you'll say, gosh, I wish I had brought that up? Because, you know, I looked at the page and I'm like, which of these 35 areas of study? Mm-hmm. So of course I wanted to know about agave. I wanted to know about Buffelgrass. Mm-hmm. They're more commonly known among laymen. And the whole seed, I love that whole thing about seed stealing. It's like whatever it was, seed stealing, I call it. But that's it's just, there's a lot of intense research, very thorough and exciting. It's not boring research, but it is, there's too much to cover.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe just to tease very briefly, one of the things I'm very excited about going forward is kind of throughout the history of the 115 years of science you mentioned, in large part, there's kind of been ecology on one side and then archaeology, or the anthropology on the other side, but really trying to bring those together holistically and merging the social sciences, the arts, and the humanities with the ecology. So we have a project called Cuenta Me Mas, Tales from Tumamoc, where we're creating a mobile recording studio and trying to, again, dig into that connection between people and place and understand that unique bond people form with Tumamoc Hill. So we can then, going back to the living laboratory idea, better communicate the results of all the research that we're just kind of talking about. And again, using art and science and merging our powers of observation and kind of better articulating this sense of place that we're talking about as well. I think there's a lot of great synergies of at hand, and that we're really excited.
I agree, and I'm seeing things that are you're just more proactive in bringing people in for the education piece. Right. And there are lots of us here that live here for a reason, came here for a reason, and really love our Sonoran Desert. Yeah. I mean, it's a big deal. So let's go global for a minute. As I mentioned at the top of the show, those of us involved in any conversations around climate change, the IPCC report, it did a great job of putting together how things are, what has to change, and how fast. I mean, it's the largest body of research ever done on this topic, mm-hmm. because it was anybody who's on the climate change page was aware of it, contributing to it, you know, making reports in it. Lots of U of A scientists were contributors to that report. Were there any surprises there for you? You're a scientist, and you're a passionate scientist. So that's my first question. And so let's see how you want to answer that, and then I'll ask my second question part of that.
The rate of change, I think, continues to surprise me. Every new iteration of the IPCC, that worst case, most exaggerated scenario, continues. When in the revision, it's like it seems that we're exceeding that. Even, I mean, continue again and again.
Yeah, we're beating all those predictions.
All the predictions.
Sadly.
It's happening so fast.
It's really accelerating.
And that's alarming, to say the least. When you look back and, thinking about Jared Diamond's collapse and the rapid transitions, environmental transitions, that then lead to societal fractioning and unraveling. It's those rapid changes that's as we were just talking about with invasive species, that's so hard to kind of catch up to. I guess I'm most surprised by this, the rate of change afoot all around us.
Which is not... that's the scary part to me. And I don't I don't go around shouting fear. I just want to go around shouting awareness and be a part of the change and hurry up, get your act together. Did it, when I read it, I haven't read the whole thing, but, you know, synopsis of it and going down as deeply as I can, I did the happy dance and said, this is such a spotlight on the significance of the work of Mrs. Green's World, raising awareness, educating people, public speaking, all of these things. What about for you? To me, the significance of what you're doing, like the importance just went up the thermostat about, 10 or 20 degrees, because a lot of that news is about drought and arid lands and hot. Of course, climate change is, in my Rotary this morning, someone told me, which I was not aware of, he just came back from Germany and Switzerland, and they are experiencing catastrophic levels of snow. And he said, Gina, 10 feet of snow on people's roofs. So villages are having to be evacuated. Roofs are collapsing. Mm. It's dangerous when that happens. Mm-hmm. So it's really extreme weather. But you're studying what happens in extreme weather.
Right.
If you're here in July on the 20th of July, you go, oh, this is extreme weather. So did it in some way, I don't know what exactly the question is, but really put a spotlight on the significance of the work at Tumamoc Hill?
Yeah, I mean, it helps me really respect and see in the new light of just how well positioned we are.
Yes.
To kind of, as you said, act on the thermostat keeping cranking up. So 115 years of data on the fluctuations of the desert, that's the best baseline for any arid environment in the world. We know in large part how the desert ticks. research that uses carbon dating and fossils, that's like little time portals back into the past that allows us to understand how the desert came to be, how it formed, all the different species that moved with past climate changes after the last glacial maxima 21,000 years ago, and the movement of species, and that each one is individualistic in its nature, meaning each species responded in its own way to how climate changes. Kind of similar, we're talking the annual plants. There's so many different ways to be an annual plant. So many ways to be a plant and a desert adapted plant. So going forward in the future, we know that that's going to continue. Each species is going to move in its own way. It's actually probably at the population level. The cultural connection and the cultural landscape that is Tumamoc Hill and how people have lived on the land. And as we're talking about harvesting the water for the agaves, using that material for so much, there is a lot of knowledge at our fingertips, and that we have such a embracement from the community that come to the lab for exercise, but it's beyond that too. It's really the landscapes, and so being able to have the opportunity to share these stories and make them relevant and to tell the story of hope. Because there's a lot of things that are challenging and scary. We've mentioned several of them. But life is so beautiful all around us. And where we live, it just inspires me at every turn to see the sunset last night from my office. And and the rains and the flowers coming
yes.
up. And
yes.
It's really miraculous. And so just to kind of harness the beauty and the excitement of living where we are and the cultural history. Wrapping all together, I think, gives us great potential.
And the desert really does speak. And I say to people, it really does speak. You only have to listen. And we took a trip back east this summer to Michigan, which is gorgeous, the lakes, everything beautiful. And my husband made an observation that I thought was very interesting. You know, it is beautiful, and I want this to come out right. What you see there are trees. That's what you see. They're everywhere. There are mountains, they're covered with trees, and there are trees and trees and trees and water. What you see in the desert is so much more. Mm-hmm. And it's true. It's just really true. There's so much more to see, including trees, but it's a whole different kind of observation of place on the planet.
And that's what's so exciting about bringing different disciplines together. You know, I go on the landscape with an archaeologist, and at first I'm walking over rocks.
And then the next minute you're walking over pot shards.
Right, or next minute I realize those rocks are actually walls. And then you just, all of a sudden this like this click. It's instantaneous.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden you just see the landscape differently. And I think for those that may have visited, or if they moved to the desert in that first day, it's like, oh my God, where am I?
It's
and then
true.
All of a sudden, you know, you start to see it in a different light. I think that's such an important way, is learning how to see the landscape and the world through different lenses. And I think academically, that's an area we're really pushing on as well.
I love that. And I think this is a perfect segue, but another intriguing part of thank God for websites, or there would be no Mrs. Green's World. And I really do a lot of research to find out what I think the importance of your story is. So there's a Proceedings of the Desert Lab. Yeah. And from what I can conclude, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, it's a living, ever-evolving body of work with open access and peer-reviewed connecting. What is it all about? Is that your brainchild?
It is. It's that fun that you mentioned that. It's it's a bit of an experiment in terms of how can you create a kind of an easier, a more no-nonsense way to get great, larger, more kind of monographic or larger research out that's be outside of the paywall and a faster turnaround.
Yes.
And so it's really an experiment in publishing in the academic setting, but also continuing to create a space for there's so much fantastic work happening out all around. And a lot of it in the academic setting, if it doesn't have a strong theoretical, global scale importance, sometimes it can be very hard to publish. And there's a lot of work that doesn't necessarily have to try to strive to be ground-changing, earth-shattering, world-affecting. It just sound beautiful, science that stands the test of time, and that deserves a place. And so I've created this
it's
journal.
Amazingly
to make that.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you know Diana Liverman from the University of Arizona. She's a wonderful friend and return guest. And she has talked about the difficulty of getting things published and the process that you have to go through. And then in many cases, because the countries have to submit the reports, and if the country is racist or sexist or culturally biased, some of the greatest science doesn't get submitted for review. So this, to me, is like the possibilities for that are so great, and I certainly wanted to bring it up. It's like, this is awesome.
Thank you.
So I'm really impressed. What do you think? These are more like people questions than science questions, but you know so much. And I know a lot because of what I've been doing for 10 years. And do you have any words of encouragement or inspiration to say to people, our time is now, get engaged, learn about what you can do, and help us all pull in the same direction? It's really worth it. And when you were talking about rainwater harvesting, almost everybody can do that. Even if you live in an apartment, you can put a bucket outside and have your water for your plants inside. If you live in Tucson during a monsoon, you know, if you don't have rainwater harvesting, there's so much we can do that is free and accessible and easy and important if we're all doing something.
Right. One of the things I'm so impressed by is there's so much creativity happening all around, and just people just trying new things, and so I'd say this kind of, it's all, inspiration is all around us. Going to your local farmer's market and seeing the new crops that are brought in, the different CSAs that are happening. We were just at dinner last night talking about, with Sato actually, creating essentially sustainable market for seafood from the Gulf of California that is almost using a CSA model and starting with crabs, actually. It's like, oh, that is so cool. Like, one, I love crab. And two, I know where I can get it and feel good about getting it. It's like, yes, more of that. What Doug
That's
Smith...
That's exciting. It's so exciting. I want to say that I couldn't go last night. I'm on the board of Sato, and I couldn't go because I had the speaker series in Phoenix. But I'm like, darn, because those are fun things to go to learn.
So ramp it up even funner. What Doug Smith is doing at Exo Bar here in Tucson, it's a mezcal bar, but he's turned it into a true
community.
Community watering hole in the best sense of that term, of music and lectures and education, and it is I mean, those are just tip of the iceberg examples, and I think every community has this
happening.
I'm
so glad you brought up Exo. Yeah. My friend Josh from Brink, that's where we meet.
Yeah.
And it's here's the what would you call it, the attraction of Exo. It's for every age, every demographic. Our Rotary Club is going to do an offsite to Exo because it's a hub. It is where people meet to connect, and you, and not to mention some of the great things you can get there.
That's right.
It's like they're all good. So let's do the, I love the crystal ball question. If you were sitting here 5 years from now, which maybe you will be.
Yeah, I hope
hopefully, so. Hopefully, me too. And what would you like to reflect on and say what you've accomplished? I mean, is there any, what are some of the big dreams? You have big dreams and you get passionate, and I love to watch your body language when you start talking about the things that are happening there. What's in your crystal ball for you? I know that's a really big, bold question, but you're already doing things. I mean, just the laboratory, the...
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny time to ask me that question because I just got my dream job.
I want to ring the bell.
And so it's really, I think for me, kind of being able to step outside of my science and my research and help make that connection with people. And right now I'm so interested in terms of connecting with those that come to the Hill for different reasons in the science, but finding a way, finding the linkages where it's of interest. We don't need for them to read the book or even listen to this whole podcast, but just finding a way to kind of make that click and to take away just a little piece of knowledge, but then that can spread. It's learning how to do that. That's an area I'm really wanting
connection
to explore.
That's connection.
And so that, and then also putting us in a position. We have an opportunity right now at the Desert Lab. For the 115 years of science, we have a lot of deferred maintenance. A lot of time has passed. So getting us in a, putting us in a place for another 115 years of success. I see that as our massive opportunity right now. So creating that platform, infrastructurally, staff-wise, just rebuilding for and to getting us set for the next era of research. In 5 years, I hope we're
and it is people like you that give me hope. And I hope that we are sitting here in 5 years because I am forever young. So final thoughts from me. Dr. Benjamin Wilder and the team of scientists at the University of Arizona's Tumamoc Hill Living Laboratory are doing the good work, the important work, the much needed work to contribute to healthier and a more sustainable planet in the face of climate change. And I appreciate you and them and all the work that you're doing and your passion and your commitment to a healthy and socially just planet. It matters to me a lot. And this time, it's like I have more questions and you'll be back, I'm sure of that. I just want to report or forward promote that on January 24th, Mindy Griffith, who's the executive director of Bagit, Coping with Cancer, it's in the bag. And a personal side note, I probably learned about five people in the past week who have either died from or have been diagnosed with cancer. Talk about a rapidly spreading disease and the work they're doing to help people walk through that process. You will want to listen to this show. And then a guy named Rob Lang, I cannot wait to interview him. He's the CEO of Farm, and it's Farm.One in New York City, local, rare, and fresh, New York City style. So I'm looking forward to that. Ben, again, thank you. I think we should say, I don't want to go off the show without having a regret, but you know, your dad is Janos Wadler. He's a James Beard Award-winning chef. That's impressive. What impresses me is that he was, you talk about an early adopter.
Right.
He went on the path of finding locally sourced food for his restaurants way before it was the cool thing to do. Mm-hmm. He was going to farmers markets. He was planting his own herb gardens.
Yep.
So he planted some very important seeds, and I know how proud he is of you. Aww. So I really wanted to say that because you're proud of him as well. But he's a thing in Tucson. I mean, he's a thing, you know, nationally, the city of gastronomy, internationally. But he was quite a pioneer.
And it's so fun to see how our worlds are kind of interconnecting and linking together. When I chose not to go in the restaurant business, but it's such a joy for both of us to have our worlds united in that way.
It's so clear when I talk to both of you apart. Yeah. So anyway, everybody, thank you for being a part of Mrs. Green's world. I hope you enjoy this podcast as much as I have. And I hope that you consider sharing it, because I think this kind of important work needs to be shared so we can all be pulling in the same direction. Yeah. Thanks, Ben.
Gianna, thank you so much. Such an honor to be here.